I've tried every miracle cream out there, and most of them end up in my bathroom graveyard. You know, that shelf of broken promises. But KPS Essentials actually works and keeps working. My skin feels smoother, hydrated, and alive again. Not fake, just healthy. Whatever this Dermanew technology is, my skin's clearly into it. It's like skincare with a PhD. They're clean, small batch, and trusted by doctors and five-star spas, and now by me. Go to kpsessentials.com and take the skin quiz. It'll match your skin to exactly what it needs. Because healthy, happy skin shouldn't be a miracle.
Forget everything you had planned for this weekend because you are sitting on your couch and winning from the comfort of your own home. I'm here with SpinQuest, where you can play hundreds of slot games, all of the table games you love, and you could even win real cash prizes. New users, $30 coin packs are on sale for $10 at SpinQuest.com.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
I've tried every miracle cream out there, and most of them end up in my bathroom graveyard. You know, that shelf of broken promises. But KPS Essentials actually works and keeps working. My skin feels smoother, hydrated, and alive again. Not fake, just healthy. Whatever this Dermanew technology is, my skin's clearly into it. It's like skincare with a PhD. They're clean, small batch, and trusted by doctors and five-star spas, and now by me. Go to kpsessentials.com and take the skin quiz. It'll match your skin to exactly what it needs. Because healthy, happy skin shouldn't be a miracle.
SpinQuest Social Casino. It's Thanksgiving time. The turkey's hot and the family's loud. Instead of football, play a different game on your phone. Live dealer blackjack, craps, and slots. Play anytime, anywhere. SpinQuest.com. This Thanksgiving, gobble up a $30 coin pack for just $10. Come play today.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
Moro Casino. America's social casino.
Welcome to Moto Casino, where the excitement never ends. With thousands of the hottest free-to-play social casino games, fastest payouts, and the best promotions in the industry. No tricks or gimmicks. Owned and operated in the USA.
Moto Casino is a free-to-play social casino. No purchase necessary. 21 plus to play. Void where prohibited.
Sign up today for a generous welcome bonus.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
Cleveland is where the urban meets the outdoors, where cultural celebrations meet rabid sports fans meet the symphony, where nobody goes hungry and everybody loves music. Fueled by passion, we are the land for life. From rich history to hidden gems, the Legends of the Land podcast shares the real stories from real Clevelanders that shape the city. From iconic chefs to grassroots changemakers, sports heroes to creative visionaries, learn why living all out is in Cleveland's DNA. Go to thisiscle.com/podcast.
Due to the themes of this podcast, listener discretion is advised. Lock your doors, close the blinds, change your passwords. This is Secrets and Spies. Secrets and Spies is a podcast that dives into the world of espionage, terrorism, geopolitics, and intrigue. This episode is presented by Matt Fulton and produced by Chris Carr.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Secrets and Spies. My guest today is Niccolo Mainoni, creator of the investigative podcast The Shadow Kingdom, produced by Crooked Media and Campside Media. The first season told the story of Roberto Calvi, the so-called God's banker, whose mysterious death uncovered a web of Vatican corruption, mafia ties, and Cold War intrigue. Now, in season two, Niccolo turns focus to 1960s and 70s America, to the coal fields, the labor movement, and the brutal murder of union reformer Jacques Yablonski. It's a story about a powerful institution captured from within, about a corrupt union boss who used threats, fraud, and ultimately violence to hold onto power, and about the grassroots uprising that took him down. We talk about what this forgotten story reveals about authoritarian instincts in American life, the fragility of democratic accountability, and what it takes to reclaim a broken system from the inside. Thanks for listening. Thanks for watching. Take care.
The opinions expressed by guests on Secrets and Spies do not necessarily represent those of the producers and sponsors of this podcast.
N- Niccolo Mainoni, welcome to Secrets and Spies. It's great to have you back.
Thanks, Matt, and thank you for the perfect pronunciation of my name.
Last time when you were on, I spent about, as I was walking around, like I was at the gym listening to the first season of like Shadow Kingdom. There's a lot of like me on the treadmill, like just mouthing like Niccolo Mainoni, Niccolo Mainoni, Niccolo Mainoni. Okay, and then I had
so
it.
Good,
yeah. I try. Thanks. I try.
Thanks, Matt. Because as listeners will may or may not know, this is our second time talking.
Yes. So for anyone who missed that one, tell us about you and the podcast.
Yeah. So we got connected the first time around some months ago because I had done and finished season one of this Crooked Media series called The Shadow Kingdom, and it was about season one was about the Vatican Bank and how it had potentially funneled money in the covert Cold War battles around the world. And in the process, a man had their top banker had died. You can listen to that at season one. It's called
Spoiler.
God's Banker.
Yeah.
Spoiler. And I was a lawyer for many years. And then four years ago, I started making kind of these series for full time. So I'm still technically a lawyer, but primarily I'm kind of a journalist slash editor.
Yeah. Yeah. So as you said, thanks for that. Last season with the Roberto Calvi story, you brought us into that world of Cold War Italy, you know, corrupt Vatican bankers, fascist secret societies. This time, very different setting. The coal fields of the late 1960s to early 1970s America. So just to start us off, like why this story? What drew you to it? It's so different from the last season in a surface way.
Yeah, very different. You're right, in a way. But then in another way, it's all about, again, a kind of a mysterious, traumatic murder. And then as you zoom out, you get to learn about this greater world, a little bit like God's Banker. But this season, very, very different all the way across the world in the kind of Appalachian, West Virginia, Pennsylvania, great coal seams of the United States area. And I was drawn to it because of the people involved who are now in their 70s. They were teens and in their 20s at the time when this mysterious thing happened. They were parents of friends of mine when I was growing up. So they would drink a little too much and talk about that time that they had taken over America's most powerful union when they were 20. And I grew up with the mythology of the story, and I thought it was a little bit of a tall tale. And this season is kind of my quest to find out, was it true? Did it really happen? And if so, you know, to get to the bottom of it. And that's what kind of this very, very different season is all about.
Yeah. So let's start with the world that you drop us into for this season. So for people who never heard of Tony Boyle or the United Mine Workers, perhaps don't remember the extent to the power of which it had. What kind of power did this union have in the late 60s? I mean, how could one man like Boyle control weather towns that heat, you know, the lifeblood of the American economy flowed?
Yeah, I mean, it's in a way, it's a moment in history that's close to us, you know, because it's not the 18th century, but it's so far removed from us today. You know, in another sense that it bears kind of reviewing that in the 1960s, America still got an enormous amount of its energy mix from coal.
Uh-huh.
And coal in America, it was dug up and processed by members belonging to the United Mine Workers Union. And the United Mine Workers Union was this kingdom, this feudal system run first by this gigantic towering figure called John L. Lewis, who essentially created in many, many ways the American labor movement. We can get into that later. His number two, the man who succeeded after the great lion, John L. Lewis, was this kind of Disney villain, Tony Boyle. And he ran the United Mine Workers like a kingdom. And basically, long story short, for your listeners, if Tony Boyle raised his finger and said, "We go on strike, America's lights and heat go out." Because without coal, there is no energy in the United States in the 1960s, 50s, 60s, and into the 70s. So the United Mine Workers, even though they commanded, you know, a couple hundred thousand workers, not necessarily huge, huge millions and millions of workers like we think of the AFL-CIO and so forth. They had this enormous power, this enormous minority rule, sort of poison pill. And so they had tremendous power. They were also tremendously rich. The union was incredibly, extraordinarily rich. And so it's this little forgotten entity in American history now, but it was ferociously powerful. And that's kind of where we set the scene. That's sort of act one, scene one it opens in this world.
So one of the early protagonists of that act one, should we say, is Jock Yablonsky. He's not a household name. I never heard of him before, but the story you tell makes a strong case that he should be. Who was he, and why was it taboo for someone like him to challenge the mine union's leadership at that time?
One of the key things of this is that his son ended up becoming a good friend of mine, a man who is now in his 80s. And he's the guy who will hear and tells us most of the story. But So my friend's father, Jock Yablonsky, was this fantastic labor leader in the 50s and 60s. And he had an idea that the union should be democratic. It should be run by the members, who are, by the way, part of America's most dangerous profession at the time. Every day or every other day, a coal miner would die in the United States that's dead. He had this great vision of democratizing the union and you know, in a sense, having them reap some of the great financial rewards that the coal companies were getting at the time. And so he dared to challenge Tony Boyle, which was, remember, the kind of the prince who had inherited the throne from the king,
the
John L. Lewis.
Hog. Yeah,
exactly. Precisely. And you didn't run democratically to do anything in the United Mine Workers. United Mine Workers was a kingdom. There was John L. Lewis for, you know, however many decades upon decades upon decades. He handed the crown over to Tony Boyle there was an election. Your listeners can't see me doing quotation marks. But it was effectively, it's a regal system. This was a monarchy. Jock Yablonsky says, you know, it's the 60s. He's a Polish immigrant. You can tell by his funny name. It's not Lewis or Boyle or Jones. It's an Eastern European immigrant's name, which was already very taboo. Sounds silly today in 2025. At the time, a Yablonsky would have been an ethnic, as they would have said, quote unquote. There's an ethnic guy running for the union. So he kind of runs headfirst into two taboos. Immigrants don't run unions, and you don't run democratically for anything for the kingdom of the United Mine Workers. So our story begins when he kind of dares to say, well, I want to democratize the union. I want to save my coal miners. I want to bring them into the 1960s.
Yeah.
And that's the very dangerous thing he dares to do.
So there's a moment early in the season when Yablonsky says, well, he's getting some advice from someone. I found it an interesting cameo. I'll leave it to you if you want to go more into that cameo or save it for listeners to discover on their own. But Yablonsky's discussing with someone in running against Boyle, and he says, you know, they'll kill me if I run. Not metaphorically, like he means this literally, as we see. What kind of system makes that a credible threat inside a U.S. labor union?
Yeah, I think I'm ready to spoil, Matt. I think it's okay. It's a fascinating part of the story, and one of the first interviews I ever did in 2018 at a quartz museum that he runs in Connecticut. A tort is like a civil wrong in legal terms, as opposed to a criminal wrong, and that is Ralph Nader. Ralph Nader of Nader v. Gore v. Bush.
The Ralph Nader.
The Ralph Nader, the great safety advocate who was known in the 60s as the great safety, and the one who will be known by millennials as the guy who they saw on TV when they were, you know, 12, that may cost Al Gore the presidential election. So that Ralph Nader in his 60s kind of vestments before he was a third party candidate comes into the story, and he encourages Jock Yablonsky to run, because Ralph Nader at the time is on this kind of nationwide crusade to spread, you know, workers' rights, consumer safety, consumer disclosure in all products that are in the commercial flow in the United States. He's on this kind of like super, super widespread crusade to bring greater safety and democracy to just about anywhere. And one of his, the people that he finds, it, be it car safety or chemicals or oil spills, et cetera, he sees that there's this guy, Jock Jablonski, who wants to potentially is thinking about running, but is not going to do it, as far as my research and many academics have found, was not going to do it until Ralph Nader says, let's do it, Jock. You should do it. You should run. And there's this fateful meeting that I talk about in episode two, which is an episode I'm really proud of. I hope people kind of get listen to one and two together. And Ralph Nader, in good faith, says, you should run, to which Jock Jablonski responds, you know, if I do it, Ralph, they will kill me. And Ralph Nader, who I confronted about this, in good faith responded, they would never. You'd be in a goldfish bowl, meaning you're so visible to everybody in kind of the United States labor landscape that to kill you would be absurd. Everybody would know who did it if they would ever do it. And of course, is taken to mean Tony Boyle, the reigning mm-hmm. king. Or so we're left to assume. That's the scene setting right before the election. And Jock, you know, listeners will hear, decides to run. And with the help of in part, encouraged by Ralph Nader, who at the time, I feel like we have to say this a lot in this series. Nobody will remember this at the time, but at the time, Ralph Nader was a celebrity. He was like Lady Gaga meets Trump meets what, like add all possible political musicals and create a package. Ralph Nader was a superstar. He was everywhere and everybody would recognize him and would be starstruck if they saw him.
I was trying to think of a good modern analogy for the role he played in U.S. politics at the time. And there's not anyone who really kind of lines up. I feel like today he'd be sort of like an influencer kind of person, but there's that doesn't even still quite describe the force that he was at the time.
You're right. There is no immediate analog because I think
it's like urgency. Greta Thunberg, but not as it's not quite the same, but that's he was in that vein.
But exactly, it's in that vein. If she was, you know, like 28 and obsessed with, you know, United States health and safety, and a Harvard law graduate. But you're right, because I think today we're kind of maybe missing a little bit of that urgency and stardom that comes from somebody who wants to do good for the environment. Kind of wonky startup. We're this is more a kind of a glossy kind of Instagram era. I don't mean to sound like an old, like angry fuddy-duddy, but for whatever reason, that's the type of stardom that was on offer in the early to mid to late 1960s. And Ralph Nader slid, you know, beautifully into that. And also, we should say I think it was his Harvard, you know, undergrad paper. I mean, astonishingly young, that was made into, then published into a book, Unsafe at Any Speed, if I got the title correct. And it was basically saying and outlining that the manufacturing process of cars in the United States was horrifically created these products that were death traps. And it was widely credited, this little kind of college essay was widely credited with the advent of seatbelts and things that, so Ralph Nader saved, you know, how many countless millions of lives. And this is when he's, you know, in 20 or 21 or 22. So this man is a superstar and you can't understand the Jock Jablonski story if you don't understand the collision with the superstar that is Ralph Nader.
It's a brief collision. I don't know if this is just sort of my millennial bias showing, so I come from a tainted jury pool, but I feel like he did not come off well here in this story. And that's not because you portray him poorly. I think you present the facts of the case as they are, and his, I don't know how much you want to go into that, but he's not the best ally.
Yeah. Yeah. This is a point that you'll hear in the show, where he doesn't come out great. And I confront him with this, and others have as well. And the big critique is that basically Ralph Nader promises this type of support and then kind of disappears. And his critics will say he promised something and he disappeared. Ralph Nader says, hey, look, do you know what it was like to be Ralph Nader in 1969? I had 75 of these people in these campaigns that I was supporting. I could give them a start. I could let them out of the gate. I couldn't sit there and, you know, chaperone every part of the campaign. So his defense to me and has always been, I did what I could and I stand by it. And while the other side, Jock's children said, we felt abandoned. And later listeners will understand why, that abandonment was critical and life-threatening.
Yeah, I'll let listeners decide how they feel about Nader's role in it. But that was quite an interesting cameo when I heard him pop up. I was like, wait, Ralph, that one?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So one of the revelations at the heart of this story is that the union under Boyle had become entangled financially and politically with the very industry that it was meant to fight, with the coal industry. And that's not just sort of corruption. It's structural inversion. It's a kind of like hyper institutional capture. How do you think that kind of like institutional rot takes hold and sustains itself?
Yeah, it's really interesting. The United Mine Workers had, for a series of reasons, become very, very wealthy as coal boomed in the heyday of coal. And they'd amassed these incredible reserves in their treasury. And so, without spoiling it too much, it had come to pass that the union, which is basically in a profession so dangerous as coal mining at the time, was really the difference between life and death in many cases. So this is the protector of the worker's life, had ended up becoming kind of a lender of last resort for the coal companies. So the coal companies would get infusions of cash from the union that it was meant that they were meant to chaperone and patrol and regulate. And, what would happen was this kind of perversion, as you said, is like instead of one controlling the other, being a watchdog, this kind of joint venture had happened at the expense of the coal miner, who was just kind of, laboring underground without knowing any of this. And this was also part of the kind of the morass that Jacques Yablonsky was wanting to say, no more. Let's become the guardian of the coal miner. And this kind of alliance is ill-suited to our mission statement. It makes us want the coal company to, commercially succeed at all costs, which is certainly a good thing. No coal miner wants the coal industry to collapse. But if you are funding the corporate treasury of the entity that is then hiring your workers in a life-threatening profession, it's hard to describe in detail, but it's a really dangerous recipe. As often happens when a lot of money starts changing hands.
It reminded me of a pattern I think that we see in American society. I mean, it's definitely not the last time it happened in American history, so it's probably not the first. But you talk about the sort of devotion that miners had toward this union and its leadership. Of course, the membership of the union is not a monolith, and there's pockets that are very pro Boyle and pockets that are sort of more anti Boyle. There's some that are quite militantly pro Boyle to the extent of like it sounds like an armed militia out in parts of Appalachia. But yet you have these, and you go through sort of like the early discovery of, black lung and mine doctors sort of ignoring the reality of what that was. But it struck me as an example of a group of people, the miners, having this almost sort of like religious fervent devotion to an organization, being the Mine Workers Union, that under a leadership has become so sort of tortured and corrupt and just cartoonishly opposed to the miners' interests, but yet so many fail to recognize how they're being screwed by these people that they're devoted to. I was wondering if you noticed that in reporting this.
Yeah, no, I did notice it. And I noticed, in a sense, also, though, taking a step back, the beauty of that institution and that moment and the devotion to it. You know, these men, there were some women, but it was predominantly men who had this community in their union that it's almost like, forget about it politically. Like, sometimes I think we think union, oh, like radical lefties or anti-union, radical right. It really wasn't political at all. These men had hard jobs and that were not, you know, tough part of the world, and it was sacred. You know, they you know, you wherever you go in Appalachian and in West Virginia, where I reported, you always had people saying, you know, we had three pictures on the wall. It was Roosevelt, it was Jesus Christ, and it was John L. Lewis, who was the head of the union. It was a brotherhood. It was spiritual. It was everything to them. It's what kept them alive. It's what paid their benefits. You know, if they got a horrific disease or if a limb was chopped off in you know, roof falls, this is what supported them, and they knew that it was tied to the company. You know, there is no coal mining without the coal company. So there is this strange alliance. None of them were, you know, radical, crazy Marxists or whatever. But it's this beautiful, what I loved reporting on was this moment in the 1960s, much more in the past, but for the moment in the 1960s, where there was this spiritual community, this brotherhood and fellowship. There was this desire for the company to succeed in some sense because you were tied to it. But the brotherhood came first, and inevitably floating above all of it, and I say this as a corporate lawyer of 10 years, there was the profit-seeking nature of the corporations and the coal companies, which, you know, many times would put profit over the health and safety of their workers and, you know, sure, often would also, you know, shine a spotlight on doctors who said there's no such thing as black lung, it's just a cough, as opposed to the brave doctors who would. But it was such a beautiful sort of long lost moment, that's Polaroid, that snapshot in that moment where you had a really, really robust union and workforce, but that, you know, seemed to be, you know, I don't want to say apolitical because they were all strongly, you know, they were many of them were Democrats. But it wasn't political in the sense that we think of today. These were hardworking people in West Virginia, Pennsylvania, and Kentucky. And I guess I'm rambling a little bit, but it was the nostalgia of a moment that I didn't live. Was really heartening, if nothing else, because of the brotherhood, the sacredness of this institution. What I'm trying to say is this, and I'll end with this, Matt. There was a sacred nature to the fellowship of the union that had nothing to do with left and right, Nixon or Kennedy. Nobody cared. The union was apolitical. It was keeping them alive, and it was their brothers holding up the roof for them. So I always thought that was quite beautiful.
And it was, at least on paper, supposed to be, and was for many of these men and their families, a protector of a way of life in that part of the country.
A protector of the way of life, exactly. Exactly. You could, if you had a union coal mining job, you could provide for your family of three. You were set.
Yeah.
3, 4, 5. They could all go to school in the area. You could get groceries. You know, you could have a car. That was a big deal. A United Mine Workers, you know, sanctioned, approved job in West Virginia or in Pennsylvania, and as I said, in Kentucky, it's in Tennessee. It was a huge deal.
Much of what Tony Boyle did, rigging elections, intimidating challengers, silencing dissent, feels more like a one-party regime than a labor organization. These are things that I think a lot of Americans like to believe happen over there, I'm saying in air quotes. Do you think we've underestimated how common those authoritarian instincts are in American institutions and have been, you know, we're talking about the 60s and 70s here?
Yeah, I mean, you know, power corrupts. Absolute power corrupts, absolutely. I think anywhere in on planet Earth where you give somebody, even a well-meaning person, and their mandate is, you know, you have the total control or the ability to totally control a group of 100,000, 200,000 men, 2 million, and you can submit yourself to regular checks and balances, or, you know, you have the freedom to just do as you want. There is a, you know, there is a weird demonic urge that bubbles up anywhere. Sure, in the United States, of course, not just over there, but everywhere. Deep in the heart of a labor union that is set to protect the lives of the of you know, at-risk workers. Yes, deeply. And you can see how quickly that sort of authoritarian bent can in a split second work for good, you know, coalescing consensus and power as Tony Boyle's predecessor, John L. Lewis, did. He was a total dictator, but he, you know, basically gave us, you know, the American weekend for workers, the notion of healthcare through your employer. That's all John L. Lewis, because he, you know, rattled his saber, united all these coal miners, and in a truly undemocratic way had, you know, the coal companies bend their knees to him. And in a split second with Tony Boyle, you know, you have a more sinister guy, and all of a sudden, disaster. But to answer your question, yes, I think it was deep in the hearts of men and women everywhere. And it's interesting and kind of uncomfortable to see how, and I don't really get into this in the podcast, unfortunately, but how John L. Lewis wielded that for good and how Tony Boyle for ill. But I should say, this podcast does not condone dictators, and nor does my answer.
I think your employers are quite on the record being against that.
Yes, that's true.
But yeah. So in Act 2 and 3 of this season, the protagonist is Jock's son, Chip, and this kind of Ocean's 11-esque crew that sort of rallies around him to help take the union back. What did that moment of rebellion represent to you while you're reporting this out? And I guess, what did you discover about those kind of characters? Because they're characters.
Yeah, so I love that question, because to me, what the most interesting part of the story has always been the second, third act, which is these teenagers / 20-year-olds who take over, you know, the most powerful union in America, which I won't say is like, you know, taking over J.P. Morgan today, but there's some parallel today to like an absurdly powerful institution that should not be taken over by, you know, people in their early 20s. And this story is very famous in American labor history because there's a kind of a gruesome murder. But so that's how people usually know that story. But nobody knows the second act. And what I found was, by interviewing these guys in their 70s and 80s who were 20-year-olds, and very movingly, the youngest of them, Bob Hopman, who was 16 and 17 when he became basically the de facto treasurer of the United Mine Workers. I did a series of interviews with him, and I really loved talking to him, and he passed away. So he unfortunately will not get to hear the story, which is my greatest regret. But I'm so glad, him among many, there's five or six other people who are no longer with us, sadly. But I'm so glad I got his words down on tape. And it showed me that, you know, these kids were, you know, these were kids from Philadelphia, from DC, not particularly well off, but certainly children of kind of the 60s, 70s movement. Not many of them were coal miners, but they had an enormous desire to bring about what Chuck Yablonsky wanted to bring out. And they fought this kind of monolithic, unshakable, super well-financed labor machine, and they won. And the story of how they did it, I think, is kind of wonderful and unexpected. And we all love a David and Goliath story. And these kids showed you and showed us and kind of showed the political moment that it doesn't really matter if you are ultra well-financed. They weren't. But they were smart. They had great legal arguments in court. They went all the way to the Supreme Court. And they were scrappy. And, you know, they took down an entrenched system and brought about change for a little while. They changed the world. They changed their world of the American coal miner. And I just think that's such a wonderful story. We all want to believe that we're capable of it. And whatever, you know, whatever big or small battles we're all thinking of fighting, you know, these guys did it. And I was so attracted to that fight, and I desperately wanted to get them on tape. And it's now there. You know, I think this is an American, it's just an American classic, this story. Mm-hmm. And I don't know of anybody that recorded these guys, you know, and Thank God many of them are now, I say many of them are, you know, of blessed memory now. And I'm just so grateful that, that we got them, and that we got to tell the story. But yes, listeners, I highly encourage you to really get past the first half, which is the famous kind of cinematic, horrible bloodshed part, because the second half is this great tale of American labor renaissance.
We're going to take a quick break and we'll be right back with more.
I've tried every miracle cream out there, and most of them end up in my bathroom graveyard. You know, that shelf of broken promises. But KPS Essentials actually works and keeps working. My skin feels smoother, hydrated, and alive again. Not fake, just healthy. Whatever this Dermanew technology is, my skin's clearly into it. It's like skincare with a PhD. They're clean, small batch, and trusted by doctors and five-star spas, and now by me. Go to kpsessentials.com and take the skin quiz. It'll match your skin to exactly what it needs. Because healthy, happy skin shouldn't be a miracle.
I'm here with SpinQuest, where you can play and win from the comfort of your own home with hundreds of slot games and all of the table games you love with real cash prizes. Right now, $30 coin packs are on sale for $10 for new users. It's all at SpinQuest.com. That's SpinQuest.com.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
Hey everybody, it's Chris here. I hope you're well. Have you ever wanted to run one of your own podcasts? Well, on Monday the 22nd of September, I'll be running a one-day workshop with my friend Jeff, who runs a Doctor Who podcast called Who Corner to Corner. And we'll be looking at the basics of podcasting and empowering you to make your own podcast. So join us on Monday the 22nd of September. The link is in the show notes below.
I've tried every miracle cream out there, and most of them end up in my bathroom graveyard. You know, that shelf of broken promises. But KPS Essentials actually works and keeps working. My skin feels smoother, hydrated, and alive again. Not fake, just healthy. Whatever this Dermanew technology is, my skin's clearly into it. It's like skincare with a PhD. They're clean, small batch, and trusted by doctors and five-star spas, and now by me. Go to kpsessentials.com and take the skin quiz. It'll match your skin to exactly what it needs. Because healthy, happy skin shouldn't be a miracle.
Extra Value Meals are back. For just $5, get a savory and sweet sausage, egg, and cheese McGriddles, plus hash browns and a coffee. Only at McDonald's.
For limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. Prices may be higher in Hawaii, Alaska, and California, and for delivery.
What's striking is how sort of strategic their resistance became. You know, as you mentioned, like there's no they weren't operating from some like established sort of like playbook. You know, there weren't like some powerful K Street lobbyists who showed up and like told them, okay, this is what you do at this time and here are the resources. Like they did all this themselves. Like a lot of media savvy, lawfare, even some light, you know, denial and deception sort of work there on the sidelines. It wasn't just sort of idealism. It was operational. How they sort of figured out how you bring down this, yeah, Goliath, as you've said.
Yeah. Yeah, boy, that's so wonderful. You know, it's I should say, Matt, I'm so giddy talking about this story because we made God's Banker, which was season one, and Cold Survivor, which is season two, back to back. And we ended up then making God's Banker much, much later, and it aired sooner. But the season I'm talking about, I made like 3 years ago. And so it's this wonderful friend who I've lost touch with and who I've now been reacquainted with. And I'm just like, yes, the whole story is coming back to me in real time. These kids had no playbook. They had no significant material money. They had no lobbyists telling them the strategy that would work in various districts as opposed to others. And I think in some way, that was what worked. You know, that their audience recognized that they weren't getting formulas thrown at them, you know, kind of canned, vetted statements, glossy slogans. These guys were professional, to be clear. They all were the highest, they had the highest level of dedication. But I think the coal miner who voted for them felt the authenticity. Mm-hmm. We seek authenticity. And these kids, in a moment of kind of glossy, dictatorial slop, pierced through all that with their genuineness of just being kids, just who were hardworking and wanted, you know, as cheesy as that sounds, the authenticity was accepted by the coal miners.
Yeah. There's real drama too in how close they came to failing more than once. You know, how much this all had to go exactly right for Tony Boyle to be held accountable. In the end, you know, from your perspective, not just as a storyteller reporting this out, as a lawyer, what does that say about how easily justice can be derailed in this country, even when the crime is as clear cut as this one?
Yeah, I mean, these kids basically, and I sort of just want to give everything away because it's much more fun, but to be cryptic, you know, to fully avenge their leader, their fallen leader, they had to take Tony Boyle down in parallel in an election so that he could go down in this parallel trial. It's like, you can't make this stuff up. It sounds fake. And so they had to time it, these two victories, so perfectly that one inch too soon or too early or too late, the whole thing would collapse. And so, you know, yeah, if they hadn't succeeded in the way that listeners will hear, you know, Tony Boyle would have potentially stayed in power and kept his kingdom. And this would have just been a story of, you know, an unfortunate death of a family that we never quite realized how or why was wiped out. It's spooky. Yeah. You almost don't want to think about it in life and in politics and American and international politics. You know, I'm from Italy where I can think of many analogs, how close we came to never knowing the truth, never having victory prevail. In fact, Matt, I choose not to think about it or I'd go insane.
It shows you that all of the happy endings in history, not just in the 20th century. I mean, I think the first, yeah, I can think of moments where like, oh, this could have gone really bad, but thankfully it didn't. And now here we are. None of that was assured. It wasn't a preordained, you know, there's no scriptwriter ahead of time saying, oh, it's okay, the bad guys are going to lose in the end. You know, like all of that had to be, people had to do that for it to happen. And I think we, looking back at those moments, we sort of, yeah, I could talk about, yeah, 1945 or something like that. You know, that was not, that outcome was never preordained.
Yeah. Yeah, the only thing that you can definitely record is the enormous amount of hard work that these people put in. You know, these people that could have been, a lot of them were very fancy, very smart, like Supreme Court law clerks. These are people who could have worked at, you know, the best law firms for the equivalent of, you know, $300,000-$400,000 a year in their 20s. None of them did that. They all thumbed their nose. They went to work for the coal miners, you know, campaign against the coal mining union for $2. They worked night and day for like 3 years. So, you know, victory looked a lot like super hard work. And I was kind of astounded. And I was really humbled. I'll say this, Matt. As a guy who spent his time in corporate law firms, doing deals and kind of corporate transactions, these kids who were 10 times as smart as I was and could have done 10 times as much in private practice and in business, really chose to do this amazing thing essentially for free for years. Like, the story is compressed in 8 episodes, but this was like 3-4 years door to door. And I don't know that I ever, on a personal level, it was humbling because I've never taken 3 years out of my life to fight for the, you know, better conditions of anyone. Mm-hmm. And I think as I was reporting this, there was kind of a therapeutic kind of exorcism that was happening within me, that as I was reporting this, I felt like in my own small way, and my God, this story, I spent years of my life on this story. In my own small way, as I was reporting these old, you know, gentlemen and ladies telling me about this incredible feat they had done, I think part of me was exercising some demons of mine from my corporate existence in my life.
Atoning? Atoning, maybe?
I was atoning. Yes, yeah. Yes. I think I was slightly atoning for, God, what community service have I done? What in the heck have I ever done for anyone in a meaningful way? And I don't know that this really counts as any meaningful community service, but it did. It was one of the best feelings I've ever had in my life, taking a bus to West Virginia and pointing a mic at an old union organizer. And you know, I was doing this while I was still a lawyer. This podcast I've been working on for so many years. And I fell so deeply in love with that feeling. You're pointing a mic in West Virginia without a deal, no Crooked Media, no Campside Media. Nobody had greenlit this for me. And you are doing it for free. All of your friends are, you know, living their lives with their, you know, families and going on beautiful vacations. And you're in Cabin Creek, West Virginia, talking for the third and a half hour to a coal miner. I have never felt so at peace, alive and centered, and that I was doing what I was meant to do, that it so fundamentally changed my life that I left the practice of law because of this story so many years ago. Mm-hmm. So there's something about it, something about those kids that made me change my entire life. I mean, it sounds dramatic, but it's objectively true. I was a lawyer before and now I am not.
Well, you documented this story for history, preserved it for history in a way that no one else after you will be able to, just because a lot of these key people aren't around anymore. So, I mean, how is that's definitely a form of community service. Part of this story will live on specifically because of you.
I appreciate that. It felt so right. You know, sometimes in life, when you're doing a job you don't like, or your conversation isn't going right, you can feel it in your guts. There's something, but you keep going. And then there's moments in your life where you're just, you know, you're in the right place, saying the right thing, doing the right set of motions. This felt like that. I hope to do more of this. I hope there's other stories out there that are disappearing or serve some, you know, have some redeeming quality. And I'd love to give my time to it, so that I might, as you say, atone, Matt, for my sins. Yeah. I was brought up a Catholic, so it's important for me to feel guilty and atone in commensurate ways regularly.
as we start to sort of wind down here, I mean, I think with this season, you're telling a story about democracy being rebuilt from inside a corrupted, perverted, personalist dictatorship. What lessons do you think this story offers about power? I mean, not just in labor unions, but in any closed system that fears transparency and accountability?
Yeah, I mean, that's a good question. I thought about that a lot in season one as well, where it was in Italy and there was kind of a fascist far right dictatorship, a masonry that was about to take over Italy. And now here with Tony Boyle as he, you know, threatens to bring full dictatorship to the union. I think in the struggle to bring democracy or, you know, a better way of government, what I was astounded by was how irrelevant our funding, prestige, a professional class of advisors, how just fundamentally irrelevant that is if you have a core set of very effective ideas, communicators who are authentic.
Mm-hmm.
And this is not a political, I try deeply to make my work, you know, not political, right, left, whatever. But I think that it's just a wonderful lesson for anyone, including myself, that if you have an undeniable message, which is communicated well by an authentic person, that person could be a 16-year-old from Philadelphia who took the bus because his mom gave him permission so that he might help the coal miners defeat the dictatorship of Tony Boyle. And if Bob Hoffman, who is no longer with us, but who I grew to really love, can kind of say that to the coal miners as a 16-year-old, and it pierces through better than any lobbyist, better than any, you know, K Street insider, better than any well-funded executive. It taught me that a lot of times the smoke and mirrors of power and prestige and money and lobbyists is completely irrelevant over the forces of authenticity. It sounds cheesy, but these guys have really convinced me that's the key. That's the key. Just speak authentically. And even, you know, veteran coal miners from Appalachia will believe you, a 16-year-old from Philadelphia, because authenticity is infectious and immediately effective. So I hope that does justice to what these guys did, this and so much more. And I should say, Matt, I was not able to add hundreds of hours of people and anecdotes. There's so many more in this story. Like, it breaks my heart. There's like 10 other people that you simply cannot include them. Otherwise it would be 100 episodes. But there are dozens and dozens of more people. And I'm sure they would say that the lessons to be taken out of the story or countless others, but if I had to, you know, pick one, I would say this.
Well, there's that book waiting for you.
Oh yeah. Well, yeah, that's right. Book is coming next. I should say there is a great book about this story called Blood Runs Cold by my good friend Mark Bradley, who wrote this fantastic book, was a good friend to me throughout this whole process, and the book was purchased by Universal and is going to be made into a movie where Cillian Murphy plays my friend Chip Yablonsky.
Oh, wow.
Or so I read from the trades. This is all public. So,
okay.
So stay tuned for, I hope, a really cool movie where my friend Chip is played by the star of our time.
Yeah. Oppenheimer himself. Yeah, no, that's cool.
Mm-hmm. Precisely.
So you've now reported out two seasons of The Shadow Kingdom, one about the Vatican and Cold War Europe, one about blue collar America right at the heart of the 20th century. How has this changed your how you think about corruption, power, or institutional rot?
Yeah, I mean, it's in a way it's spooked me a little bit, because I, having had to dive deep into the grimy gears of the machinery of power, I've seen a lot of crazy behavior that I thought was made up. And so on one hand, I've been spooked by how deep and low we can go. On the flip side, I have been greatly, I have found myself in awe of how far we can go raising ourselves up like these teenagers that took over the union. So it's a bit of a yin and yang. I've been sobered by how low we can go and how beautifully we can rise up as humans. As a result, I'm squarely back in the middle. Mm-hmm. But that's a great question. You know, it's a great question. It's one I hope to keep working on, you know, and I don't know that we'll ever find the exact answer.
There's no objective answer to it.
Yeah. What have you in your many interviews and your studies, what have you understood about, you know, the gears of power and of human beings? Give me your insight, Matt, so that I can steal it from you.
I'm in a pretty cynical place right now. I think maybe in a couple years time, I'll have a more sort of objective view of this.
Okay.
I'm definitely sort of pointing out, I think in my own thinking, and this definitely, I saw strands of this here in this story, how the kind of exceptionalism that Americans like to bring to their idea of self and their sense of their own history, how this stuff happens over there and there aren't, you know, armed autocratic militias running around Appalachia at parts of our history, you know, that sort of post-war idyllic period we like to think of, how that's not entirely true. And a lot of the things that we are, a lot of things that we like to think that we aren't susceptible to, we absolutely are. And perhaps that strain, that virus has been kind of dormant in our DNA the entire time. And I think this story is an example of it surfacing in one particular place. In this case, Tony Boyle's led coal miners union.
Yeah, I agree. I agree. How very biblical of you, Matt. There is great evil within us all over the globe, but a great capacity for redemption if we choose to look upwards.
And the idea, like I said, you know, with looking back to like 1945 as an example, or, you know, how Chip and his crew overcame Tony Boyle and all those forces, how those sort of happy endings that, you know, okay, the good guys win in this case, how that was never preordained, that work had to be done to achieve that. And we are not special in our own timeline.
Yeah, I agree. Wonderful. I'm going to steal that from you and I'm going to say that was me.
Go ahead. Yeah. anything else you'd like to cover today that we haven't yet?
No, I think that's it. I'm excited for people to listen. And it is, depending on when we air, it's August 25, first two episodes. And then they come out every week.
Yeah, this will be out. So August 25th, the season starts. This will be out the following weekend. I believe that's the 30th. Is that Saturday?
Oh, perfect.
So by the time folks hear this, at least one of the episodes will be out already. You're airing one a week?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
Amazing. Cool. Okay.
Yeah, awesome.
So enjoy and subscribe and we'll see you on the next season.
On the next one. Do you have an idea of what that is?
I have a few actually. Okay. A few actually. So stay tuned.
All right. Yeah. Can't wait to hear about it. Yep. Links to all that will be in the show notes, including the book that you mentioned. I'll put that in there too. What was that book called again?
It's called Blood Runs Cold by Mark Bradley. An incredible book.
Awesome. Link to that will be in the show notes, as far as also where folks can find The Shadow Kingdom by Niccolo Mainoni from Crooked Media and Campside Media. Awesome stuff. Great to have you back. Really great story. Thank you so much, sir.
Thanks, Matt. Always a pleasure.
Listening. This is Secrets and Spies.
tried every miracle cream out there, and most of them end up in my bathroom graveyard. You know, that shelf of broken promises. But KPS Essentials actually works and keeps working. My skin feels smoother, hydrated, and alive again. Not fake, just healthy. Whatever this Dermanew technology is, my skin's clearly into it. It's like skincare with a PhD. They're clean, small batch, and trusted by doctors and five-star spas, and now by me. Go to kpsessentials.com and take the skin quiz. It'll match your skin to exactly what it needs. Because healthy, happy skin shouldn't be a miracle.
Forget everything you had planned for this weekend because you are sitting on your couch and winning from the comfort of your own home. I'm here with SpinQuest, where you can play hundreds of slot games, all of the table games you love, and you could even win real cash prizes. New users, $30 coin packs are on sale for $10 at SpinQuest.com.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
I've tried every miracle cream out there, and most of them end up in my bathroom graveyard. You know, that shelf of broken promises. But KPS Essentials actually works and keeps working. My skin feels smoother, hydrated, and alive again. Not fake, just healthy. Whatever this Dermanew technology is, my skin's clearly into it. It's like skincare with a PhD. They're clean, small batch, and trusted by doctors and five-star spas, and now by me. Go to kpsessentials.com and take the skin quiz. It'll match your skin to exactly what it needs. Because healthy, happy skin shouldn't be a miracle.
Forget whatever plans you have this weekend because you're staying at home and playing on SpinQuest. And there's never been a better time to sign up than right now. New users get $30 coin packs for just $10. All the table games you love with hundreds of slot games and real cash prizes. That's at SpinQuest.com. SpinQuest.com.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
I've tried every miracle cream out there, and most of them end up in my bathroom graveyard. You know, that shelf of broken promises. But KPS Essentials actually works and keeps working. My skin feels smoother, hydrated, and alive again. Not fake, just healthy. Whatever this Dermanew technology is, my skin's clearly into it. It's like skincare with a PhD. They're clean, small batch, and trusted by doctors and five-star spas, and now by me. Go to kpsessentials.com and take the skin quiz. It'll match your skin to exactly what it needs. Because healthy, happy skin shouldn't be a miracle.
Forget whatever plans you have this weekend because you're staying at home and playing on SpinQuest. And there's never been a better time to sign up than right now. New users get $30 coin packs for just $10. All the table games you love with hundreds of slot games and real cash prizes. That's at SpinQuest.com. SpinQuest.com.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
I've tried every miracle cream out there, and most of them end up in my bathroom graveyard. You know, that shelf of broken promises. But KPS Essentials actually works and keeps working. My skin feels smoother, hydrated, and alive again. Not fake, just healthy. Whatever this Dermanew technology is, my skin's clearly into it. It's like skincare with a PhD. They're clean, small batch, and trusted by doctors and five-star spas, and now by me. Go to kpsessentials.com and take the skin quiz. It'll match your skin to exactly what it needs. Because healthy, happy skin shouldn't be a miracle.
SpinQuest Social Casino. It's Thanksgiving time. The turkey's hot and the family's loud.
Instead of football, play a different game on your phone. Live dealer blackjack, craps, and slots. Play anytime, anywhere. SpinQuest.com. This Thanksgiving, gobble up a $30 coin pack for just $10. Come play today.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
Cleveland is where the urban meets the outdoors, where cultural celebrations meet rabid sports fans meet the symphony, where nobody goes hungry and everybody loves music. Fueled by passion, we are the land for life. From rich history to hidden gems, the Legends of the Land podcast shares the real stories from real Clevelanders that shape the city. From iconic chefs to grassroots changemakers, sports heroes to creative visionaries, learn why living all out is in Cleveland's DNA. Go to thisisCLE.com/podcast.